Now, before I forget, there's two things I forgot to specifically say in the previous recording. One is about it says this already on Canvas, but one of the big problems is getting people to read everything. The pre-labs are not only before the lab, they're the day before the lab. Okay, so each pre-lab has an absolute deadline. It will automate, Canvas will cut you off at 23:59, the day before the lab. So you can't expect to be able to do the pre-lab an hour before you come in here or the break between lecture and lab. It won't be available to you. The pre-lab has to be finished the night before, except for this safety one, and except for the one that's labeled as metric system, because obviously you haven't learned anything yet. It can't have been due yesterday. All the others, though, some of which aren't available yet but will become available as we get the packets made, cannot be late at all. It's not me shutting you off, it's Canvas shutting you off. So that's another foolish way of losing points, because the pre-labs are close to the easiest. Not as easy as attendance, but close, as long as you give yourself more than 2 minutes to take them, because all the answers are in the packets. All right? The idea of the pre-labs, not just to give you a comparatively easy batch of points, is so that you don't come in clueless. That's a big problem with labs. What are we doing today? Oh, my partners will know. I'll just follow them. Well, that's bullshit. You need to know what you're going to do that day and how you do it so that you have time before we have to get out of here to get it done. Okay? So do those. Did I say two things just now? Or was that just all one? That was all one. What was the other thing? Hopefully it'll pop up again in my mind. So the meat of, I shouldn't say the meat since I'm a vegan, but the bulk of what we're going to talk about today scientifically is a batch of scientific fundamentals. And this takes a while to get through, but hopefully it'll be less painful for you than it is for me. It's painful to speak loudly for as long as it takes. But anyway, can everyone hear me in here too? All right. I want to start with quantities and units. By the way, this slideshow is not with the normal slides, which is why I had trouble finding it right before we were starting. But I'll make sure that I put it in on the Hoffman site on the pages for current term recordings. Okay, so there's a link already for current term recordings. That's where I will upload today's lecture recording. I'll also include a link to this slideshow. Okay? Anyway, I want to start with quantities and units, which are different things, not just differently spelled words. They have different meanings, both important to science. Probably some of you have a feel for what these things are. Does anyone want to say what either a quantity is or what a unit is? Yeah, a quantity basically is anything that you can measure. And there's all kinds of measurements in science, right? We make measurements as part of experiments. There's no limit to the number of quantities, because there's no limit to the types of measurements you can make, right? How is that different from a unit, though? What is a unit, in other words? Well, the things you measure are quantities. Yes, units are predefined sizes in which you make those measurements. So it's best just to give examples. That's easier than to put it into words. But I should warn you that people confuse quantities and units all the time, including on quiz one. Make sure you understand. Don't just say, yes, I understand. When I say, does that make sense? And Or does everyone get that? I actually mean that honestly. Tell me if you don't, and I'll say it another way. But don't just try to get to the end of the day by saying, yeah, we understand. So let's just talk about some examples. Give me an example of a quantity. Yes, number of people, or just more generally, number of items, or number of particles, number of something. That is a quantity. What's another example of a quantity? Keeping in mind that a quantity is something you can measure. What other things do you measure besides numbers? Water is a substance. You can measure things about it. Weight is a good example of a quantity. Now, both of those example quantities, number of items and weight, can be measured. That's what makes them quantities. But they can also be measured in specific units. That's the difference between units and quantities. And for any given quantity, there's numerous choices of units, any of which could be used. Right? So for number of people, which is what your example was, you could measure that in millions of people, right? That would be a unit. Or dozens. For weight, you have all kinds of choices. What's an example unit for weight? No, but I'm glad you said that. You said kilogram, right? 3 ounces is allowable, yes. This brings up a couple important points, both of what you said. I'll address yours first, since you said it first. Kilograms is a unit, as grams is, or megagrams, or whatever. Those are not units, though, of weight. Those are units of mass, which is a different quantity. Okay? Mass is the quantity telling you how much matter is contained in a sample. How much material it's made out of. Weight, on the other hand, is an example of a force. Specifically, weight is the force due to gravity. There are other kinds of forces as well, but weight is the force due to gravity. Now, the two get confused all the time, mass and weight, even by people who should know better, scientists. Instructors get this wrong. It's not surprising that they get confused because they're interrelated. That's because the force due to gravity depends on the mass. The more massive an object is, the greater the force of gravity. But they're not the same thing because the weight simply is the force. It's not the stuff. The mass is the stuff. Now, this also brings up something that pisses me off. There's a lot of things that piss me off, but one of these is that you measure weight with scales, right? Or that's one way you measure weight, like a bathroom scale. And there's one of the things that pisses me off is that the United States is one of only 3 countries remaining hanging on to this ridiculous system of measurement that we use, which I like to call the silly system, which includes things like ounces and pounds for weight. Well, the rest of the world, the bathroom scale is metric. It's not the silly system. But the other thing that pisses me off about this is that what you are directly measuring with a bathroom scale is weight, the force that you're applying due to Earth's gravity on you, right? And so the units that you read should be weight units. And they are, in the United States, the big numbers, usually on the bottom, are pounds, right? Pounds is a unit of weight. But then, they also have on most scales the metric equivalent, the so-called metric equivalent, which is kilograms. Well, kilograms is not the metric equivalent of pounds. It's not a unit of weight. It's a unit of mass. Now, if you take that bathroom scale on a ride into space with you, your body is made of the same mass that it was down on Earth. But when you get into space, you're weightless because there's no force of gravity being applied to your body. And you step on that scale, it's going to be zero. Well, it's a lie to say 0 kilograms because you have just as many kilograms of mass in your body as you did before you left Earth. It is not a lie, though, to say that you're 0 pounds because you no longer have weight at that moment. All right? So really, what they should do, if they're going to have a metric equivalent, is to use the metric unit of weight, which is not grams or kilograms. Anyone know what it is? It's named in honor of someone who cared about gravity a lot. The Newton is the unit, yeah. So you should measure your weight in newtons. Now, the reason that we can get away with this is because the assumption is that people are not going to leave Earth with their bathroom scale. So what they do is, what the scale does is basically measure your weight and then mathematically convert that into a mass on the assumption that you are on Earth, near the surface of Earth. They're not the same thing, though. So those are a couple things that piss me off. Now, you said ounces, which is correct. But that's in the silly system.
Yeah.
And something about the silly system that gets sillier each year is my personal experience with it. So I have to change the number every year. So this year, 48 years ago, when I was in fifth grade, I remember the teacher saying, "Today we are going to learn the metric system. And it's important for you to pay attention, because very soon that's all we'll be using here." And it's almost 5 decades later, we're not close to being embracing the metric system, even though it is far simpler. You can learn the metric system in 15 minutes. You still haven't learned the silly system. For instance, speaking of mass and weight, what is the silly system unit of mass? You know that the kilogram is the metric system of mass, but if you want to use your own system that you got brought up with, what would be your units of mass? What? Ounces is weight, not mass. Grams is metric, not silly. It's the slug, which probably no one in here was ever taught, even. Right? But, I mean, if you use another example of a quantity, which is distance. Distance, length, width, height, those are all really distances, right? There's just another name for distance. All kinds of choices of units, right? But it's a bitch to know how many inches there are in a mile, or in a rod, or how many square feet there are in an acre. It's just a pain in the ass to work with the silly system. They were all invented, all those units were invented for some reason, but there's no coherence to it. The metric system, on the other hand, is all based on powers of 10, which is why you can learn it in 15 minutes. You just have to memorize some prefixes, and you have to memorize some base units. And that's it. You're done. But Americans approach it as though it's a grim chore to learn the metric system, which is why we can just thumb our nose to the rest of the world since we're powerful for the time being, and say, no, we're not going to do that. Anyone know what the other two countries are? Myanmar and Liberia. And us. Okay. So, everyone have a feel for the difference between units and quantities? To the point where you can demonstrate that difference on a quiz. Okay. Well, let's use a couple more examples then. What's another example of a quantity? Distance is one, yeah. But since I did already say that, let's use another. Because it's not a measurement. It's something you can make measurements about, but it's not a measurement itself. It's a substance. A quantity is a measurement, yes. Something that you actually measure. If I tell you to measure the water, what does that mean? Does that mean the volume of the water, the wetness of the water, the viscosity of the water? All of those things are quantities. Viscosity you can measure, right? Wetness or humidity. What else did I say? The volume, those are quantities. So I gave three more away, but you should be able to come up with any number of quantities. There's no limit. Anything that you measure is a quantity, pretty much. Don't trust me?
No, I was kidding.
So, what's another example?
I was going to say, like, the packs of goldfish, you get, like, six in it. It's, like, packaged in the store, six in it, that's a quantity.
Yes, but that's a quantity that's already been said. Number of items. What other kinds of measurements do you make, though? Area is a good example. And I say that's a good example because this brings up the next major topic. Oh, by the way, area, like any quantity, has some number of corresponding units. So units and quantities correspond. If you're measuring a quantity, you measure it in units for that quantity. Right? You don't measure, like I said, weight in mass units, you measure weight in weight units. Just like you don't measure mass in distance units. You don't say, I have 3 feet of mass, right? You have to use mass units. So the units, you have a choice of units, but they're constrained by what your quantity is. Is that clear? Now, what would be your choices of, there's many, many choices, but what are some choices of units for area that you gave as a quantity? Square feet, if you want to work in the silly system, or square inches, or acres, or square rods, or, you know, there's no limit really. What about if you're in the sensible system? Meters, kilometers. Meters is the base. That's length or distance. Area would be square meters. Okay? And this is where we transition to the next topic. So if are you satisfied now with your knowledge of the difference between units and quantities? Because I want to say that each of these two things, quantities and units, come in two varieties. There's two kinds of units, two major categories of quantities as well. And those categories are fundamental and derived. So there are fundamental quantities, there are derived quantities. And correspondingly, there are fundamental units and derived units. Now, While I say there is no limit to the number of quantities, which is true, there is a very severe limit to the number of fundamental quantities. A surprisingly small number of fundamental quantities, even though there's millions and millions of quantities. What makes a quantity fundamental is that it is not made up of other quantities. It stands by itself. A good analogy for this is with chemistry. A molecule is made up of, well, some molecules. A compound, a molecule that's a compound is made up of, well, actually, I don't even have to say that. A molecule, by definition, is multiple atoms. All right? So it's made up of more fundamental things. The atoms are more fundamental than the molecules. Even in the case of an oxygen molecule, which is, they're, both of the atoms are oxygen, but there's still two of them. Okay? The oxygen atom itself, though, would correspond to a fundamental quantity. The molecule would correspond to a derived quantity. A derived quantity is made up of one or more, two or more quantities. And that's why I said your area example is a good example. Distance is a fundamental quantity. It's not made up of other things. It stands by itself. Okay? But area is not fundamental. Area really is just made up of two distances, right? Length and width, each of which is a quantity. It's the same quantity twice, but that's why it's derived. Area is derived. And therefore, any unit that you use for area, since area is a derived quantity, any unit of area is a derived unit. And correspondingly, any unit of a fundamental quantity is a fundamental unit. So, the meter, which is the metric base unit for distance, is a fundamental unit because distance is a fundamental quantity. Well, there's only, I forget exactly how many, only like 10 or so fundamental quantities in the universe. Not all of which we care about in biology. But it's surprisingly a low number. Let's look at this list of some quantities here and determine which of them are fundamental and which of them are derived. What about time? What would you say? Fundamental. It does not depend. It's not made up of other things. It is its own quantity. And that's one we care about in just about any experiment. Not all, but just in science in general, not just biology. Time, by the way, is an example of overlap between the silly and sensible systems. So it's really the it's the only exception to the fact that the metric system is based on powers of 10. We don't use metric time is really the time it's always been, based on 60, fractions of 60, basically. So we don't say a tenth of a minute, for instance. You know, we still use seconds, minutes, and hours in metric, just like we do in the silly system. By the way, even though we're stuck with the silly system as a society in this country, that's not true for scientists. Scientists all around the world use the metric system universally. So time, you notice some examples of those for units. Every one of those units, though, whether it's days, seconds, hours, whatever, since time is a fundamental quantity, all of those units are fundamental units. Is that clear? What about mass? We've already said what it is, but is it fundamental or derived? It is not derived. It's fundamental also. One of the few. And so the base unit for the metric system is the gram. Like I said, for the silly system, it's the slug. Unlikely to use that in the rest of your life. Length, is that fundamental or derived? Well, I already told you. It is fundamental also. But doesn't it seem fundamental? It's not really made up of other things, right? It is its own quantity. Volume, on the other hand, is derived. Why? Because it's three dimensions of distance, right? It's length, width, and height, all of which are just different names for distances. So it's kind of like a molecule made out of three of the same atom. Right? The atoms are fundamental. And when you collect three of the same kind together, you still have a derived thing, even though they're all the same kind of atom.
Sorry, it's been like 3 years since I've been
Do you get what I'm saying about volume not being fundamental? It is derived because it's really made up of other quantities, namely distances. Doesn't matter that they're all the same. Length, width, and height are all distances. If a quantity is made up of two different or more different things, it's derived. But also, if it's two of the same quantity, it's still derived. That brings us to force, which we'll make another example. Is that fundamental or derived? What'd you say? It is derived. Now, what did I say is the metric unit of force? Well, I said weight, but weight, all weights are forces. Where the hell are my pens? No, that's mass. What is the metric unit of weight? You learned this 10 minutes ago. The Newton. And Newton himself told us that force equals what? Anyone take physics? Yes, mass times acceleration, F equals ma. Well, this tells you that force, which includes all weights are forces, not all forces are weights. But any force, whether it's a weight or another force, is, you can see from this equation, is derived. Because it's made up of these quantities. Force has a mass component and an acceleration component. Well, acceleration itself already is derived. Because acceleration is distance per time per time. It's made up of three quantities. So acceleration just by itself is already derived. It's going to be even more derived when you add in mass. Force is a derived quantity, not fundamental. And therefore, whatever choice you make for your unit of force, Newton or foot-pounds, whatever, those are going to be derived units to correspond to the derived quantity. Is that all good? Okay. Temperature, what about it? Fundamental or derived? It is fundamental. So this list is heavily biased toward the fundamentals, because like I told you, there's only like 10 in the whole universe, and we've listed several here. The vast majority of quantities are derived. Temperature, by the way, is an example of something that we have two. There's been multiple temperature scales over the years, but we actually still use two different ones, both considered to be metric. In the silly system, what do we use? Fahrenheit, yes. Or you can just say Fahrenheit. Where the hell is my... Oh, here it is. A temperature scale, the Fahrenheit scale, what are the units? Degrees, which have the symbol, a little circle, right? Degrees, Fahrenheit. So just like the rest of the silliness, you have to memorize numbers that aren't nice, even powers of 10. What's the boiling point of water at sea level in the Fahrenheit scale? You were brought up on this system.
212.
So that's one tick mark on the scale. Down here we have freezing of water, which is what? At one atmosphere. 32. And notice that between 32 and 212, that's 180 divisions, 180 degrees between those. Well, you can measure the same things in the centigrade scale, which is also degrees, but it's degrees centigrade or degrees Celsius. That's metric. But here it's just so much easier because the scale is based on water, which is so important to so many things. So we define 100 degrees centigrade as the temperature at which water boils at one atmosphere, at sea level, in other words. And we define 0 degrees as the point at which water freezes. Notice there's 100 tick marks there. It's the same temperature range as the 180 degrees that the Fahrenheit scale takes up. But 180 divided by 100 is 1.8, which is why you see that 1.8 factor in conversions between Fahrenheit and centigrade. This makes a hell of a lot more sense, though. It's easier to remember. Well, that is metric. That's one metric temperature scale, but we also have the so-called absolute temperature scale, which is also metric. Now, the units of absolute temperature are exactly the same size as degrees centigrade, which are also units of temperature, but they're different units on a different scale. Same exact size. What do we call them, though? We call them kelvins. We do not call them degrees Kelvin. The absolute temperature scale is called the Kelvin scale. The units are called kelvins, but you do not use the degree symbol. It's just K. Capital K after Kelvin, Lord Kelvin. The reason this is the absolute temperature scale, though, is that it's actually measuring what temperature is. Temperature is an indication of the average speed of particles in a sample. The faster they are, and they're all moving at their own speed, but you can take an average of all those, that population, right? Whatever that average is, that's an indication of the temperature, or the other way around. The temperature is an indication of the average speed. Well, notice that there is a 0 Fahrenheit, which is below freezing, and a 0 centigrade, which is at freezing of water, but it's not the bottom of the scale. Things are still moving at 0 Fahrenheit and 0 centigrade. Not as fast as they would be on warmer samples, but still moving. It's called the absolute temperature scale because 0 is set at the point at which there is no movement of particles at all anymore. That's as cold as you can get by definition, because you can't be negatively moving, right? You're either moving it with some positive speed or you're not moving at all. And if you're not moving at all, that is absolute 0. 0 kelvins, not 0 degrees Kelvin. Okay, so don't use the little degree symbol. If you want to compare this to centigrade, 0 kelvins is negative 373.15 degrees centigrade. Very cold. Right. But you can't, there's no such thing as a negative measurement on the Kelvin scale. It's the absolute temperature scale. Number of particles we've already talked about. Now, you can count any kind of particles, houses, humans, planets, whatever. But that kind of determines what units you should use. What kind of measurement you're making kind of determines which kind of units you use for convenience. For instance, if I am counting planets, it might make sense to just use integers as units, right? Because there are so few of them in this system. If I'm counting, on the other hand, molecules or atoms, there's a hell of a lot of them before they even become visible. I mean, it takes a hell of a lot of them before the tiniest amount can become visible to our eyes. So, yes, we could count those using 1, 2, 3, like we do planets. But if we're using a sample that we can actually see, that number is unwieldy, right?
Yeah.
By virtue of being large. And really huge numbers are just a pain in the ass to use. So, for number of particles, when it comes to very tiny particles, that it takes a shitload to actually have a workable amount of, we use the units called moles. Now, a mole is simply a number, just like a dozen is a number, right? Dozen means only 12. You never say, I bought a dozen, and expect the person to know what the hell you bought. Say a dozen roses or a dozen planets.
Mm-hmm.
Dozen by itself is just a number. Similarly, a mole is just a number. It's called Avogadro's number, after a dead person. What is the value of Avogadro's number? Anyone know here? It is 6. Keep going. 6.022 to 3 places. It's good enough. Times 10 to the 23rd power. Huge number. A number that's so huge, it's almost inconceivably huge. And we would never want to use that if we're counting something macroscopic, right? You don't want to use that to count planets. But atoms and molecules are so tiny that this is actually a manageable number. The reason why this is the number has to do with what we see on the periodic table. Talk a lot about the periodic table in the lecture room, but on this version, you see the red numbers, which are not integers. They're some number to some number of decimal places, right? Those are called atomic masses. And you can think about it two ways. If that number is in atomic mass units, if you express it as atomic mass units, then that's the number of atomic mass units that are in one atom of that type, which is inconceivably small and not very useful to work with. But another way you can think of it is, for instance, let's use magnesium, 24.3050 atomic mass units. You can also say that that number is in units of grams per mole. Okay? So what that means is if you carefully measure out with a very high-resolution balance, exactly 24.3050 grams of magnesium, then you have one mole of magnesium atoms. You have this many magnesium atoms in that many grams. Okay? So it's that many grams per mole. So this times that number would be how many you actually have. And that is a very big number. Okay. Let's go on to the metric system itself. Yeah, go ahead. Yes, number of particles is fundamental. It's not made up of other things. Now, the metric system, like I said, can be learned quickly. It's really just a matter of memorizing base units and prefixes. Here we see not base units, but prefixes, or prefaces, if you prefer. Notice that in the middle of this table, the middle row, doesn't have a prefix listed. That is the so-called base level. Now, there aren't any units listed here. These are just prefixes that you would use before the unit name. The unit name depends on what quantity you're measuring. But we use the same prefixes for all units, for all quantities in the metric system. There is no prefix for the base. We just use the base name itself. So if we are measuring mass, that's the quantity, we would be using as the base unit grams. Right? Grams is the base unit of mass. We don't have to use grams, though. It's convenient, depending on your sample size, to use grams. If you're using a really big sample, then yes, you could measure it in grams, but you'd get a huge number, which is hard to work with, right? Or at least inconvenient to work with. Or if you're measuring a tiny sample, you could still measure it in grams, but it would be 0.000 until you finally get to a non-zero number, which is also inconvenient to use. That's why the prefixes have been invented, to give you a choice of sizes of units to use for whatever is convenient for your particular use. All right? So the symbol itself, there's a symbol for the unit, like the degree symbol, for instance. Or for mass, it would be G. That's the abbreviation for grams. That has to be there to tell you what unit you're using. But in front of that, you can also use one of these prefixes. If you are actually using grams, it would just be G. If instead it makes sense to measure it in 1,000 grams at a time, then you would use a kilogram. Kilo means 1,000 times, or 1,000 of those. In the silly system, for instance, longer distances we would measure in miles. Well, a mile is really just 5,280 feet. It's another unit given a different name, but it really means 5,280 feet. It's more convenient if we're using those distances. Similarly, a kilogram is just another name for 1,000 grams. But it's treated as a single unit when you measure in thousands. The important point here, though, that makes the metric system convenient is that every step, either up or down, is a change in an order of magnitude, or in a number of order of magnitudes, I should say. An order of magnitude is a power of 10. Okay, so if you start out with 1 of something, and you increase it by an order of magnitude, you have 10. 10 is one order of magnitude bigger than 1. 100 is 2 orders of magnitude bigger than 1, right? Because it's 10 times 10 as much. It's 10 squared times as big. The 2, the exponent, tells you the number of orders of magnitude. Are you following me on that? Okay, well, everything above in the table, the base, is bigger than the base as a unit. One step in this table is 3 orders of magnitude bigger, though. 1,000 is 3 orders of magnitude bigger than 1, right? Because 1,000 is 10 to the third. 1 is 10 to the zero power. So that's 3 steps in exponent, 3 orders of magnitude. And that's where we put our commas. Every 3 orders of magnitude in very large numbers. Okay? So kilo whatever is 1,000 of those whatevers. You would never use lowercase k by itself. It would have to be kg if it's kilograms, kn if it's kilonewtons, you're measuring weight, and so on. Kilometers if it's distance. Depends on what your choice of quantity is. All right. A step above kilo is mega. It's also a 3 order of magnitude step up to 10 to the 6th, which is a million, compared to kilo. But compared to the base, mega at 10 to the 6th, or 1 million, is 6 orders of magnitude bigger than the base. Right? So 1 megameter is 1 million meters in 1 unit. And similarly, you go one more step to giga, that's three more orders of magnitude. Every step here is three orders of magnitude. So you don't ever use these symbols for the prefixes by themselves. They have to go before the symbol for the actual unit. Is that clear? Now notice that all of the symbols for the prefixes above the base are capital letters except for kilo. They chose capital letters to remind you that those prefixes are making the base bigger, are making it bigger than the base. Capital letters. It would be consistent if they'd used capital K also for kilo. Why did they not? Why?
Goes
no. No. Already used it for what? For Kelvin, you're right. Capital K means Kelvin. So that would be ambiguous. Lowercase k means kilo, even though it's bigger than the base, it's a lowercase letter. Okay, you can also make the unit smaller than the base if that's more convenient. You're measuring small things. Once again, it's three orders of magnitude smaller each time you go down one step. Milli is 1/1000th of. Kilo is 1,000 of, or 1,000 times that. Milli is 1/1000th. Right? So it takes 1,000 milli whatevers to equal one whatever. Whereas it takes 1,000 base units to make one kilo unit. Is that all clear?
Mm-hmm.
Well, notice these are all lowercase to remind you that they're getting smaller than the base. M, pretty obvious why we chose that for milli. You get to micro here, and people erroneously put U for this. This is not a U. This is a Greek mu, which is a Greek M. It looks like this. It has a, I don't want to say tail because it comes first, but this hangs down. This part, it's not this. That's a U. If you have this low hanging thing in front of it, that's a mu, which is the Greek M. That's why we used it. M was already being used for milli, so we used a different version of M, the mu, to indicate micro. But micro is a millionth of the base. It takes a million micros to equal one base. Well, if you expand this all the way out, notice that it goes from 10 to the 24th power, ridiculously huge, down to 10 to the negative 24th power, ridiculously small. That's because this is not a linear scale. This is orders of magnitude difference on each step. So no matter what you're doing in science, particle physics at the tiny level, or astrophysics of galaxies and whatnot, it's somewhere in this range. This is an enormous range. Way bigger than we need for biology. Which is why I'm not requiring you to memorize every one of these. That's why I have another table to look at in the next page. This is almost the same table. The red parts are red because those are too big or too small for biology to care about, and you don't have to know those. The white rows were already in the previous table. All right? And those are three orders of magnitude jumps each. But the yellow ones were not in the previous table. Those are new additions. And notice that the yellow ones are on either side of the base. They're not far from the base. And that's because sometimes the base is perfectly appropriate. Sometimes the step above in three orders of magnitude or three orders of magnitude lower is really too much. It's convenient to have one order of magnitude steps either up or down from the base to have even more choices of units. Okay, so these ones you have to know as well, the white and the yellows. Deca with a K means 10 times. So a decasecond is 10 seconds. All right? That's one order of magnitude, 10 to the first. 100 times the base is hecto. Hectosecond, 100 seconds. And then one more order of magnitude and you're at kilo, like we've already talked about. And then from there you go by three orders. One order of magnitude smaller is deci. Be careful with deci versus deca. Dec means 10, by the way, which is why we call the metric system a decimal system. It's all based on powers of 10. That's why we say that 10 years is a decade. Deci, though, is 1/10 of the base. Centi is 1/100. That's why we call a penny a cent. It's 1/100 of a dollar. Now, one thing that's important when we get to this next major topic is that when you're measuring something, you have choice of units, right? If you choose small units to measure your sample, then you're going to have a big number of units compared to if you measure the same sample in bigger units, right? The bigger the units are, the smaller the number of units you're going to have in that sample. Right? You could measure the distance from here to Tucson in kilometers or in meters, but if you measure it in kilometers, you're going to have a lower number than if you measure it in meters. That's going to be important to keep in mind when we go to dimensional analysis, which is next. Anyone have any questions before I start this, though?
You said you were uploading this presentation.
I am going to put it on the page called Current Term Recordings on the Hoffman site. Okay, now to dimensional analysis, which students try to avoid doing correctly as though it hurts them. But I'm going to try to force you to do it correctly. There's all kinds of reasons to use dimensional analysis, most of which we won't get into in this course, but one major reason for using dimensional analysis is for conversions, conversion problems. Why do we call this dimensional analysis? Well, dimension is another name for a unit. And we call it dimensional analysis because doing it correctly requires that you write down the units. This is the part that you cannot get students to do willingly. They just want to punch numbers into a calculator, get a number as an answer, and never write down a unit. Well, you can easily get a nonsensical answer that way because you don't know, since you don't write down the units, whether you've set the problem up correctly. Dimensional analysis gives you a way to check whether you're doing things correctly. All right, now, there's a slight error on this. There should be a point after 150. Should be 150 point. For reasons I'll get into in a minute, or probably several minutes. But this is a typical conversion problem. Now, you can convert from one measurement in, let's say, the metric system to another unit in the metric system, or from silly system to silly system, but this is an example of going between silly and metric system. All right? Before we get to that, though, let me just say that a conversion problem involves really one amount of something. In this case, what is the quantity that's being measured here? That's a unit. You told me that you know the difference between... Yes, distance. The quantity is distance. So you have a distance between two points, right? You can measure that in a lot of different units, but it's always going to be the same true distance, right? If it's not changing. So conversion really is just re-expressing the same measurement in different units. It doesn't change the actual quantity. And what it all boils down to in a conversion problem, which is not, as I said, the only use for dimensional analysis. But when you use dimensional analysis for a conversion problem, it is really, mathematically speaking, just serial multiplication, meaning that you're multiplying one thing after another some number of times. Now, in mathematics, what do we call things that get multiplied together? No, that's the answer. The product is the answer. I'm not talking about the answers. For instance, 3 times 9 has the product 27. That's the answer. What are 3 and 9, though, in that statement, 3 times 9?
Factors.
Factors, exactly. If you're adding them together, they're called addends. If you're multiplying them, they're called factors. So when I said that a conversion problem is really just serial multiplication, it is just some number of factors multiplied one after another. Okay? Well, you have a bunch of things in parentheses here, each of which individually is a factor. All but the first one, as you see, are labeled as conversion factors. The first factor is simply the original measurement, which, as this example says, that original measurement was 150 miles. Right? So that first factor is 150 miles. You could write it simply as 150 miles, but notice that all the other conversion factors are fractions. So I like to just make everything a fraction. You can make the original 150 miles a fraction simply by putting it over 1. Right? Now, as I said before, the distance is not changing. You're just expressing it in different units, right? But you're doing that by multiplying the original distance, 150 miles, by things over and over, the conversion factors. Well, you have to do that, since the distance doesn't change, you have to multiply that original measurement by things that are not going to change the distance. In mathematics, what is the only thing that you can multiply things by to not change the value? 1, the multiplicative identity. That means that every conversion factor really is just another version of 1. That way, if you start with a measurement, you can keep multiplying it by 1 over and over, you still have the same distance. If you measured it, if you multiplied it by 2, you wouldn't have the original distance anymore, right? So each conversion factor is just another way of writing 1 in fraction form. There are infinitely many ways to write 1 in fraction form. But what has to be true if that fraction equals 1? What's an example of a fraction that equals 1? 2 over 2. So in general, what has to be true of the fraction for it to equal 1? The numerator has to equal the denominator, and they both have to be non-zero, right? So 1 over 1, pi over pi, anything over the same thing, as long as it's not 0, is equal to 1. That means that every one of these conversion factors has a numerator that is equal to the denominator. The only thing that's different is the units in each one. Okay? In other words, 1,760 yards equals 1 mile. Therefore, this factor equals 1, and when you multiply the original distance by 1, you're not changing the distance. You're just changing the units. Does that all make sense? Okay, the reason that you do this, though, is because you want to express this original distance in some other units. You don't change the distance, you change the units. And you could do it all in one jump if you knew the correct conversion factor to go from where you are originally, which is miles in this example, to where you want to be according to the question, which in this example is millimeters. If you knew a single conversion factor to go from miles to millimeters, you could do this in one multiplication step. But most people don't have that memorized. So we use dimensional analysis to do it stepwise using some things that we do know, including knowledge of the prefixes that are important in the metric system. All right? Every one of these conversion problems goes the same way. It's the same steps that you use that I'm going to do this one just like this. Well, let me explain this one first. Step one in all of these, though, is that you simply write down the original measurement, what you're given. That's 150 miles. It's not 150. That's not dimensional analysis. It's 150 miles. Write down the unit. And then put it over one just so that they're all fractions. Okay, that's where you are at the moment. You're not done because you need to be in millimeters. You can tell by writing miles that you're not done yet. Right? That's the whole point. So, step two, after you've written down what you start with as fraction form, is almost an automatic step, an unthinking step. So don't look at that. Just pay attention to what I'm doing. I'm in miles at the moment. I can't be in miles for the answer. Therefore, I have to get rid of miles as unit, right? Speaking of fractions, the only way I can do that is if you put the same unit in the other side of the fraction. That's why I say this is unthinking. Don't worry about any numbers yet. You need to get rid of miles because they can't be in your answer. They're upstairs right now, so put miles down here before you do anything else. All right? And those are going to cancel. Now, you need another unit. You need to go from miles to something else. That's within that conversion factor. That's why it's called a conversion factor. And you might have 5,280 feet per mile memorized, or 1,760 yards per mile memorized, or none of this because it's a silly system. But 5,280 is what I grew up with. So let me just use that instead. 5,280 feet per 1 mile. Now, here's what I was saying before. If you're measuring the same sample with bigger units rather than smaller units, you're going to have a smaller number of those large units than you would have a number of small units. So any given conversion factor will have two units, one on top, one on the bottom. Whichever one is the larger unit will have the smaller number because they have to equal each other, right, in order to equal one. Feet is much smaller than miles, so it's not surprising that it has the large number and miles has the small number. It always reminds me of the old joke about how many pieces do you want me to cut the pizza into, 6 or 8?
18.
And the guy says 8 because I'm really hungry. It's not any more pizza, right? You're just using smaller units and getting a bigger number of pieces. Now, if we stopped right there, our answer would be in feet, which we know because we've bothered to do this correctly. And that's why we know we're not done, because the answer has to be in millimeters. So we're still in the silly system. Same process, though. I need to get rid of these feet. They can't be in the answer. So almost unthinkingly, I put feet down here. Yeah. Well, I'm doing it differently. If I use 5,280, if I didn't have that memorized, but I had 1,760 memorized, I would do it this way. And that's why I say if you knew one to go directly from miles to millimeters, you could do it in just one step. But I need to get rid of feet. So I can go from feet to anything I want that's a unit of distance. And most of you probably know that it's 12 inches in 1 foot, right? Once again, the smaller unit has the bigger number associated with it. But this equals this. That's why this factor equals 1. Okay, now we're at an important point, because I don't want you to memorize all kinds of conversion factors, but there's one that I do want you to memorize, and that's for distance, particularly going from the metric to the silly or from the silly to the metric system. And the reason this is important to memorize is because it's not an estimate. It's exactly correct. Okay? I need to get rid of inches here, but I'm going to centimeters. There are exactly 2.54 centimeters in 1 inch. 2.54000, as many zeros as you want to use. It's exactly equal. That's not rounding off, which is not true for other conversion factors. That's why it's useful to memorize it. But this is a turning point in the process here, because this is allowing us to go from the silly system we've been up to this point, jumping into the metric system. Because the inches cancel now and the feet cancel. If we stopped there, we'd be in centimeters. But we still, even though we're in the metric system, are not done, because the question's asking for millimeters. Okay, still with me? Okay, here's where your knowledge of the prefixes pays off, which you might not have these memorized yet, but you will. If you're experienced with the metric system, it would be a simple matter to go from centimeters to millimeters. That's the ease of the system. But I don't recommend that you do that unless you are really experienced with the metric system. Instead, do it this way. If you are in the metric system, but not where you need to be, which is where we are, we're at centimeters, we need to be at millimeters. Go from where you are at the moment, which is centimeters, or centi-whatever, in this case it's length. Go from where you are in the metric system to the base, which would just be meters, M. All right? That way, you can rely on what you've memorized centi meaning. The prefixes are all related to the base, not to each other. So if you memorize, as you should, that centi means 1/100th of, that means 1/100th of the base. It's smaller than the base. The base is meters. And therefore, it gets the bigger number. There are 100 centimeters in 1 meter. Now that you're at the base, you can go from there to wherever you need to be that the question is asking for. In this case, millimeters. But once again, as always, you get rid of the one that you're in, because that can't be in the answer. You go from the base to millimeters, which is mm. That allows you to remember what milli means, which is 1/1000th of. So it's smaller than the base. It gets the bigger number, 1,000 millimeters in one meter. Everything now cancels, because you bothered to do this correctly, except millimeters. And if you only write down the numbers, you'll not only not get credit on a quiz question, but you could easily flip one of these upside down and not realize it's wrong. And that'll get you a preposterous answer. So bother to write the units. That's the only proper way of using dimensional analysis. We're not done, though. This is just the setup. The next step is to actually do the multiplication. And this can even lead you to trouble with a calculator. Multiplication and division, which is the only thing we're doing here, right? There's no addition or subtraction. It's just multiplication and division. They are equal in the hierarchy of mathematical operations, which means you can do them in any order you want, and you'll get the same answer. And so there's all kinds of ways you could enter this into a calculator. You could enter 12 divided by 100 times 150. Of course, why jump around? The straightforward way of doing this is to just keep hitting multiplied by for all the top ones. 150 times 5280 times 12 times 2.54. You can enter the ones if you want, but you don't have to. Times 1,000. Don't hit equals. Divided by all the ones that aren't 1. In this case, it's only 100. And then, finally, when you put them all in, dividing each lower one, hit equals one time at the end, and you won't get rounding errors. Now, did anyone do that? Because I don't have this memorized. Oh, it should be the same as this, though. Right? So, you can write this answer as this one is written. I mean, the calculator will give you this number, right? 241-401-600. That, by the way, for two reasons, is not the answer. That's what the calculator tells you. That's not the answer. That is the magnitude, which is part of the answer. The complete answer has to have the magnitude, which is the size, the number part, and the units. Right? If you say, how big is Earth? And I tell you 12, totally meaningless, right? You have to have the units listed. So that's one reason why just the number would be wrong. But it would also be wrong if you wrote this whole number with millimeters next to it. And that's because of a different topic, but related. It has to do with significant figures. We started out with, and this is why I said you have to put a point here. We started out with 150 point. That has three significant figures. Our answer can't have more resolution than that. So we have to round our answer to three significant figures. Notice that we have some numbers in here that only have seemingly one significant figure, like 3 or 1. But these are all exact. So we, for ease, just write 3, but it's 3 point as many zeros as you want. The only thing that constrains this as far as significant figures is concerned is this original amount, 150 point. Okay, so you can't have more than that in your answer, and that's why it has to be rounded at this place. 4 is under 5, so you round it to 241,000,000 millimeters. Now, if you do that, 241,000,000 millimeters, that would be correct, because you have the magnitude and the unit. But it's not convenient. I was talking a little bit about this earlier. This is why you make different choices of the prefixes for convenience. It's unwieldy to have all of these zeros trailing, right? It's a pain in the ass to write them out. So instead we use what's called scientific notation. This is standard notation. There's really two reasons that we use scientific notation, and one of those reasons is much more important than the other. One reason, the relatively unimportant one, is convenience. For a big number, it's just a pain in the ass to write all the trailing zeros. For a tiny number, it's a pain in the ass to write 0.000 until you finally get to the non-zero part. So that's one reason we use scientific notation. But another has to do with ambiguity with respect to significant figures. All right? Well, on a number like this, actually, I shouldn't have said this is correct. This is not truly correct. On a number like this, though, if you have 241 million, which this is, then in scientific notation, you would write this as 2.41 times 10 to an exponent, right? In this case, to the sixth millimeters. Oh, 8. Sorry. 2.41. That's the convenience aspect. It's just shorter to write it this way than bother with all those zeros. But the more important reason we use scientific notation is that if you have a number with trailing zeros, like 150 to begin with, or in this case 241 million, then you don't know whether those zeros are significant or not in standard notation. Anything that ends in zero in standard notation is ambiguous. When I write 10, you know that is 10. But is it 10 with two significant figures or with one? Well, the one, as a non-zero number, is definitely significant. The zero might or might not be. If I'm using a measuring stick that can only measure to the nearest 10 units, then this zero would not be significant. I'm using a stick, though, that measures to the nearest one unit, then the zero is significant. You just can't tell from standard notation. So I would express this in scientific notation either of two ways. If there are two significant figures, I would write it as 1.0 times 10 to the first. If there's really only one significant figure, because I can't tell the ones place, I don't have enough resolution in my instrument, then I would write that as 1 times 10 to the first. To a calculator, these are the same thing. But this one has one significant figure, and this one has two. That's the real utility of scientific notation. The part that comes before the times 10 to the whatever tells you exactly how many significant figures there are. Whether they're zeros or not, however many digits there are in this part, that's how many significant figures there are. Is that clear? This one has one, this one has two. Well, if you don't have a period, that's why it's an error. If you just have 150, you don't know whether there's two or three significant figures in that. If you put the point, though, that tells you that zero is significant. And if you wrote it as 150.0 miles, that means you can tell apart tenths of a unit. So this would have four significant figures. And in scientific notation, we would write that as 1.500 times 10 to the second. Is that a question? You see the difference there? Tell me if you don't. Yeah. You don't have to if there aren't any zeros. Let's say that these were all non-zero numbers. You would still have to round it to the number of significant figures that you have in your to begin with. So you'd still round it here. If this is an 8 and these are all non-zeros, since 8 is above 5, you would round it to 2, 4, 2, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. But that would be standard notation, and that's why you wouldn't want your answer to be in that. I guess I shouldn't have said yes. I should have said no. Yes, you want it to be in scientific notation so you know exactly how many significant figures there are. Now, this is the question I always ask people. Does this dimensional analysis process make sense to you? Mm-hmm. To the point where you can do it on your own on a quiz? Mm-hmm. This is the answer I always get. And then the quiz is usually close to zero. So don't expect to remember to do this a week from now. Do it sometimes. Practice it. It's always the same exact method, though. You're getting rid of something you have, putting it into other units until you are in the correct units. Okay. Now, we're not done yet. We're done with that slideshow. Next topic is some definitions, basically. I want to distinguish three important definitions, which are accuracy, precision, and resolution. They're all important and they're all different. Anyone want to guess what accuracy is? Or not guess, just tell me. Sorry, I didn't hear you. Well, yes, this has to do with measurement. So the goal is to get the truth, right?
Yeah.
Accuracy is closeness to the correct answer. Closeness to the true value in a measurement. Now, a lot of textbooks use the good analogy of throwing a dart at a dartboard to represent the taking of a measurement. If you have a measurement to make, you use whatever instrument is appropriate for that. But it's kind of like throwing a dart at a dartboard, where the very center of the dartboard represents the truth, the real value. If you make a good measurement, that means throwing the dart and hitting close to the center. That has high accuracy. Right? Just closeness to the truth. Which makes sense for each individual measurement. You can talk about the accuracy of a single measurement, because each measurement is some distance from the truth. All right? Next in the list is precision, which is often misused by people who should know better. Precision doesn't really make sense for individual measurement, like accuracy does. Precision has to do with repeatability. For instance, if you have a sample that is not changing at all, and let's say you're measuring the weight by putting it on a scale, if the sample is not changing at all, you could measure it repeatedly, right? You would expect to get the same answer each time from the instrument, right? Well, if it has high precision, high repeatability, you will get very close to the same answer, if not exactly the same measurement. That's what high precision means. But it only makes sense when you're talking about multiple measurements of the same thing. And in the dartboard analogy scheme, that is represented by throwing multiple darts. Group of three darts is like three measurements, right? Well, if you have a tight grouping, three land very close to each other, that's high precision. Notice, though, that you could have a very tight grouping not even hit the board. So it's possible to have high precision at the same time you have low accuracy. It just means the instrument is always going to give you the same wrong answer. Obviously, you want high precision and high accuracy in science. It's also possible, though more rare, to have low precision and high accuracy. Or high average accuracy, I should say. This is one of the reasons why we make repeat measurements, right? So we can get an average of those, which hopefully is closer to the truth. Well, in the dartboard scheme, you could throw three that don't hit the board, but they form a triangle that's centered right on the middle, right? If you take the average of those, it's right on the truth, even though none of them was really close to the truth. So that would be low precision, high accuracy. What you want, though, is three bullseyes, high precision and high accuracy. So that leaves the third one on the list of definitions, which was resolution. Now, the noun form of resolution, I mean the verb form, sorry, resolution is a noun. The verb form is resolve. To resolve means to discriminate. Discriminate means to tell things apart from each other. Right? For instance, if we discriminate based on sex, that means we're telling apart males from females when we really shouldn't be. But discrimination in science means being able to tell that two different measurements are indeed different. And that depends on the instrument, how high the resolution is. A simple to use example, though, is I could make a mark on the board. I'm sorry, two marks. You have to have two actual measurements for resolution to come into play. To demonstrate it, that is. If I make two marks on the board, and if I stand close enough to those, then I'll be able to resolve them, meaning tell the difference apart. I can tell that it's two separate dots if I'm close enough, because the resolution of my retinas in my eyes will be high enough to tell them apart. If I stand back farther and farther, though, there eventually will be a distance at which it appears to me that there's only one dot, even though there are two. That means I would fail to resolve them. I wouldn't have enough resolution to tell them apart. Just like I was saying up here, with the 10. If I can't tell 1 mile from 2 miles on my stick, because it only has increments every 10 miles, then I don't have any scientific standing for telling you that this has meaning, this zero place. I can only resolve to the nearest 10 miles, not the nearest 1 mile. Right? So that's what significant figures is all about, resolution. How much resolution you have in your instruments and measurements. Now, an example of this would be with weight again. If I tell you to hop up on the bathroom scale and tell me what your weight is, it'll be, you know, in the silly system, be some number of pounds. And I'll say, okay, I write that down. Now, stay on the scale. I'm going to hand you this postage stamp and tell me what the combined weight of you and the postage stamp is. Well, you're going to give me the same number, right? Even though the postage stamp has weight. It's just you can't resolve it with that instrument because it doesn't have high enough resolution. If you put it onto a scale with very high resolution, though, there would be clear difference between the weight of you and the stamp and just the weight of you. And that means you would have more significant figures in your measurement. That's why you want to write trailing zeros after the decimal point if they are actually significant. This 150.0 means whatever device I was using could tell the difference between 0.1 and 0.2 units, a tenth of a unit, in other words. So this is meaningful, even though it's a zero. It's a significant figure. Any questions on those three? Okay, let me think about whether there's anything else I had today. I don't think so. How much time? Yeah, go ahead. Oh, you don't turn it in on paper. You do it just like all pre-labs. Yes. Yeah, the pre-lab quizzes. And I'm glad you mentioned this because I'm the only instructor that does this thing the first week. Everyone else does a kind of a different lab the first week, which is why this first handout might not make sense according to what I said today. But that's one thing I wanted to mention. The other, though, is at the ends of these packets, I think, Rachel, the author of these, wrote, next week you'll have a quiz over blah, blah, blah. Ignore that. My quizzes are what I've already told you they're about. The previous week's lecture, mostly. I didn't mention it at the time, though. I said most of the questions are about the previous week's stuff. There might be a question or two each quiz, though, about what you're doing that day. So that's another reason why you need to come in not clueless. If you do the pre-labs, you know what you're going to be doing that day. And if I have any of those questions, those will be real general, easy to get questions if you've read it. The specific questions will be about the previous week. And similarly, anything that you have written up here is from a different instructor. So even though some of this applies to you, this is not your stuff. I'll tell you the stuff I want you to know and do.
So for clarification, this is for the pre-lab?
Yes, the pre-lab questions that you do on Canvas, the answers are in that.
And then to whatever...
Well, there's also, I think there's a video you have to watch.
And then to whatever function that comes before the activity that we did in the lab, that
Goes hand in hand with the recording I make and the stuff that you did in the previous week. You didn't do anything today, you just listened to me. So it'll all be in my recording for this first quiz. For all the other quizzes, it will be in my recording from the previous week and in from what you did that previous week. That's why you have to go through with the activity even though you're not getting any more points for it after the quiz. You need to know what you did and why you did it for the sake of next week's quiz. Yeah, go ahead. Well, this is the new plan. I didn't do this whole revamping. so I'm learning too about this. But yeah, there will be a paper copy each week for you to pick up. I also, though, will post PDF versions. Probably. I'm not going to promise that I post PDF versions because that will make it more likely that you'll skip lab and just get the PDF version. So pick up your paper copy the day you're here. I also am just covering my ass because I might forget the PDF since they don't exist yet. But yeah, this pre-lab thing is kind of a mess at the moment, but you'll get the hang of it. It's really just a matter of going on to Canvas and follow the instructions, which have to do with reading that packet that you got from the lab. Anyone not satisfied? Anyone want some more? You want me to do another dimensional analysis example? I said, what's what? A mole is Avogadro's number of things, just like a dozen is 12.
No, I thought you were asking that. I have that right here. I'm sorry.
No, I said, do you want me to do another dimensional analysis example? Yeah. Yeah, I know you're not the first to say that, even though I got right on it to that's where I was running that from. So the site works. There must be something about the link is not giving you the right URL or something. I'm going to check that when I get home.
Because it works on my phone.
It still does?
It works on my...
Wait, what?
What works? Oh, the thing that didn't work with
the
Alexa.
It works from the link?
Yeah, it works or from my Apple stuff. I just don't know if it's because it's like other...
It wasn't working from the on-campus. Because it said, like,
Astraea's
Wi-Fi wasn't supporting this website.
Well, maybe there was a problem. Well, no, but
I'll try again when I get home.
Yeah.
It was working for me.
I'll check things when I get home, but I don't know whether I'll be able to figure out what the problem is because it's not the URL.
Yeah.
I'm running it.
Yes, yeah. So it should probably work eventually.
Hopefully.
Maybe there's a good connection
I don't really have any idea yet. I'm going to have to look at things when I get there. But we'll get it fixed. If it doesn't, then as soon as I figure it out, it will be soon enough for you to get things done. All right, is the chatter to mean that we're done? Okay. If you guys are satisfied with your ability to perform on this quiz that I've already told you usually is a bomb... then feel free to leave.
Yeah.
Spend 1 week practicing this stuff.
This is the quiz I have to get an A on, I'm assuming.
No, this is usually the lowest of all the quizzes.
Is it because people don't, like, they don't tend to do